The Section 17 IRAs are likewise exempt from federal income taxes. So those who want to export to have an opportunity there also. When the IRAs were organized in the late 1930s, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was devoted to the village concept. As of then, and perhaps today, many of the villages do not have the willingness to fight with the BIA. As I indicated yesterday, the native mind does not like confrontation. So that through the decades, and to some extent today, the BIA, by force of personality, pushes the IRAs around, particularly if the IRA has borrowed government funds. The BIA always called their loans every year. All of the income, then, for example, in the canneries in Southeast, all of the income from the sale of their canned salmon went back into the federal treasury. It went back into what we call a revolving fund. It was not gone, it could be reloaned. So that the village IRAs, who theoretically were the managers of the canneries, had to get down on their hands and knees in order to get working capital for the next summer's operation. You did not have a continuing line of credit where the government would have a hard time calling a loan. Had the BIA fostered regional IRAs, there you have a board of directors which has more strength of personality to push the BIA around. And of course, we have to be contemporary. We're not now in the late 30s and 40s, and even the 50s. We are in 1984. Today, nationwide, the Indian tribes are pushing the Secretary of the Interior around in these internal disputes between the BIA and the various tribes. Even during the late 30s and 40s, I never felt that the authority of the BIA over an IRA, this oversight, particularly when you borrow money from them, was that important, because with a strength of personality, you could beat the BIA around. The cannery and boat loaning experience in Southeast, and the stores up in to the westward, the great economic drive of the IRAs were stores, 50, 60 stores up here, financed by the BIA through the IRA. The profit made by the stores and the profit made by the canneries and the boat loans down in Southeast was nothing. They all went in debt. The money was dissipated, and the fault of the dissipation of the money, the fault of the loss, was totally BIA. I knew some of the BIA god figures that had charge of the money for the IRAs. And they were typical bureaucrats sitting in Washington, D.C. They knew everything. The fact of the matter is they couldn't tell a salmon from a halibut. But they had charge of the IRA money. But today, with the strength of the personalities of the Indian leaders, that day of being bossed by the BIA is no longer exists. Or if it does exist, it's the fault of the Indian leaders themselves, because it is possible to push the BIA around. Now, when an IRA gets its money from other than the revolving fund administered by the BIA, you do not have that kind of oversight. You can do, the IRA can do with its own money, as long as it's not government money, as it pleases. I believe it possible to get non-government money for the IRAs. I believe it also possible to organize, even today, area-wide IRAs. The Inuit community of the Arctic Slope was, its constitution was approved in 1971, in June. And the election, the ratification by the people was in August of 1971. Now, that's not so many years ago. And as far as I know, it is the only area-wide IRA in existence in Alaska. I'm not at all convinced that the IRA as a business organization up on the slope was that successful. But notwithstanding lack of business success in the Inupiat community, the Arctic Slope, the promise is there, the possibility is there. One of the great accomplishments of the area-wide IRA up on the slope, the Inupiat community, the Arctic Slope, was its efforts at protecting the land. It has brought major lawsuits for the protection of subsistence, of sovereignty, of dominion, with respect to various land problems involving the North Slope Eskimos. There's still, because the IRA is a tribal entity, it has authority, and under its constitution, approved by the Secretary of Interior, it has authority to protect the land of the tribe today. And that litigation, while it's not been that great so far as success is concerned in winning the lawsuits, probably should have had a better lawyer. the opportunity for the Inupiat Eskimos to protect the land through the area-wide IRA is magnificent. So as an indicator, I have great faith. Let me throw out another great hope of the IRAs that's possible. We have what is known as the North Pacific International Salmon Fisheries Commission, or something like that. It has vast authority over the fisheries of the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific. Because of the tribal quality of an IRA, when it speaks to that commission, and if you please, even if the commission were to ignore the desires of the native people, as spoken by an IRA, because of the tribal quality of the IRAs, it can go to an international forum, at least by way of persuasion. It could demand membership on the North Pacific Salmon Fishery or International Fisheries Commission. It could demand membership on it. So that, let's assume the IRAs along the seacoast and even up the rivers too, because the interior fishermen depend upon fish too, the interior people. Supposing there were an association of IRAs, or maybe a statewide IRA, who used this association, call it, of land owning, culture encompassing, authority that it has inherent in its organization, it's going to have pizzazz. It's going to have clout. It's going to have the only competitor for the Native movement, aside from IRA, are profit-making corporations. Profit-making corporations, anchor corporations, do not speak as tribes. They speak as General Motors speaks, or Ford Corporation, or some profit-making corporation. It doesn't have the power of public opinion. You know, we're not merely addressing the people of the state of Alaska when we speak as tribes. We're speaking to the conscience of the United States. And if the conscience of the United States is not that expressive for our desires, there is an international forum. The mere fact that the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People has a certain amount of recognition by the United Nations is a very hopeful sign, but it's an illustration of what the tribal quality of the IRA organization can have. To summarize that, I believe that the modest amount of oversight that the BIA has is not important, and that's the only disadvantage that I can see. But I would like to, if I may, with the chairman's permission, talk about some of the other thoughts that have been expressed the last 2 days. The expectations, the goals of ANCSA. I'm a little bit fearful that the hearings that this commission is undergoing is going to raise too many hopes. We here, I'm sure, all know that the commission has no congressional authority, thank heavens, in lots of ways. We here in this room realize that this is really a public opinion assistance to the Native people. I'm not entirely sure that the Natives in general have that awareness of the limitations of this commission. We've heard that many people express that the Settlement Act was a beginning point, that we're going to build on it, that we're going to go back to Congress and get more. Perhaps we should scrap ANCSA. A lot of thoughts like that. Well, I find it very difficult to believe that there's any real movement in the Congress that they're going to increase the land, some real substantive changes. I can believe that certain structural flaws, such as 1991, that might be extended. Exemption from real estate taxes is another flaw that I believe this commission could very materially assist in having extended another 10 years or so. But so far as getting more land, or getting more subsistence rights, it's going to be quite a fight. But let me give you some thoughts about if there be a recommendation for more land, let me give you some ammunition for your report. Alaska is a vast country. It has great wealth. Let's take oil as an example. There are 14 geological formations which give a promise of oil within the state. That is to say, known geological formations. Who knows how many there actually are? The Prudhoe Bay discovery involved two areas of land adjacent to each other, each containing 90,000 acres. And in those, in the ARCO, Exxon, British Petroleum, Standard of Ohio discovery, there were someplace between 5 billion and 15 billion barrels of oil. And let's say today's market price of oil is $30 a barrel. One of my disappointments during the Settlement Act was on the state share of the money, $500 million. Oil was then selling for $3 a barrel. The Audisville Native Association argued that instead of the $500 million, we would divide that at the then current price of oil, $3 a barrel. That's 167 million barrels. Just supposing we had taken that $500 million in kind, that is to say oil, rather than the cash. Well, my mind can't multiply 167 million barrels by $30. Too big a figure. But the 180,000 acres, which then comprised Prudhoe Bay, I believe is 1% of one geological formation. So that what was expropriated, and I hate that word, expropriation. There's a lot of Native people who don't know what expropriation is, but they know what stealing is. And many believe that the two words are synonymous. The expropriation that took place in ANCSA took from the Native people a vast wealth, way, way more value than the 44 million acres and the $1 billion. I simply used oil as an illustration, but it's also true of hard minerals, coppers, mountains of copper up here, gold, you name it, we got it. Now, there are a lot of people who believe that who believe in what Felix Cohen called the menagerie theory of Indian occupancy. The menagerie theory is that the native relationship to a land, to the land, is something like a wild animal's relationship to a land. A wild animal, of course, moves around, doesn't have fixed roots, usual patterns where the food is, but there's no sense of dominion or ownership for the average animal. Of course, we here in this room and all Native people know that the menagerie theory is nonsense, that there is such a relationship to the land. But the menagerie theory gives credence, belief, support to those who say that natives don't own the minerals in the land. They only have surface rights. Now I'm talking orthodox law. There are many, many a lawsuit, court decision by respected courts, indicating that when the natives have been dispossessed of their land, that they should be paid the value of the land, including the minerals. That is to say, when the natives had dominion over an area, and the key word is dominion over an area it comprehended ownership of everything in that area, including mineral rights. In 1946, the Congress passed what is known as the Indian Claims Commission Act. There is an inherent flaw in the Indian Claims Commission Act because it authorizes the various tribes to sue the United States for money, for lands lost, for this expropriation that I mentioned. It is not a vehicle for the recovery of land. But the Congress has set the standard in the Indian Claims Commission Act for its morality in treating the Indian people. It's fair and honorable dealings. In order to win a case for money again, in the Indian Claims Commission Act, the Indian tribes had to prove that they were not treated in a fair and honorable manner. The United States had committed some dishonorable act in the expropriation of their land, or in the case of the Aleuts, Floria Lechenoff's area, Lilies. In the case of the Aleuts, dementia too, sorry about that. The fair and honorable dealings is they were held in slavery. Well, their lawyers did a beautiful job in recovering that judgment. The landmark case. Anyway, we do have a criterion, a standard, a gauge by which the morality of the United States, the public opinion of the United States, the influence on the Congress, that's right in front of us. It's an act of Congress. Whenever, according to the Indian Claims Commission Act, and I grant you, in a sense, it's abolished, that is, we can't use it anymore, we can't file new cases. But even so, the mores of the conscience of the United States is thereby established. Now, utilizing that criterion, that gauge, that standard, as applied to 1984 and the Alaska Native Movement, has the Congress been fair and honorable to the Alaska Natives?
I guess everybody here has his own answer to that, and I think it's unanimous.
I'm not at all, I'm cynical enough to believe that that's going to be a hard bill of goods to sell. But there it is. When you compare what was taken from us with what we are paid, utilizing the fair and honorable criterion, there's only one answer. Again, I hope that the village people in particular don't believe that Mr. Berger and the Alaska Native Review Commission is all answers to all things, but there's some ammunition for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. It's been suggested we might take a break in a minute or two for a cup of coffee and then return. When we do, David Case had a question he raised yesterday. I'll ask him to restate it, and Martha Dementiev was going to respond to it, and some of you might wish to make further statements. I'm in your hands, and perhaps we can chat informally about that over coffee. I want to thank Fred Paul for telling us about the disadvantages of IRAs. We'll have to ask, in due course, we'll have to ask David Case and others to research the difficulties that might be faced, but it seems to me, and I just make this observation, and there's nothing profound about it, but quite apart from legal and constitutional questions, there are public attitudes. And it seems to me that in Alaska there is a sentiment that it can be detected among the non-native population that there should be no governments that aren't, so to speak, multiracial. That is, there should be no governments that aren't, quote, public, unquote, governments. And the idea of governments limited to persons of a certain tribe or tribes is something that I think many people, and it doesn't matter what country you're in, any of the Western countries, have some difficulty accepting. Now, it should be pointed out that President Reagan, in his statement on Indian policy, signed by him at the White House just about a year ago, did acknowledge the principle of sovereignty and the right of Native Americans to their own governments defined on tribal defined on a tribal basis. But that seems to me to be something that can't be overlooked. The other thing that occurred to me is that the North Slope, and I'm sure this is by no means an original thought, but the North Slope has its own public government in which the Eskimos are a majority, which may mean that for people there, the idea of a regional IRA is, at this time anyway, thought to be superfluous. Now, there may be no other Alaska Natives in quite the same situation as the North Slope Borough, that is, with a public government which they in which they are clearly a majority. That may mean that it may be an illustration of the differences as you go from one region to another of Alaska. Well, perhaps we might just take 5 minutes for a cup of coffee and then return. Yeah, sorry. Oh, yes, David, what is your question? How about letting us have that before we...
I think when I asked the question, I was trying to ask it so it didn't sound like a question, but I'll try to be a little clearer this time. But I thought that Martha Dementieff seemed to me to pick up what I was getting at, too, and that is the relationship between natives owning land and protecting, promoting native cultural values. And I guess what I was asked, this is the way I would ask the question. How can natives own land or stock as individuals and promote cultural values as whole communities? And I think that's what I was trying to get at. And I think I detected some of that, part of that question in some of Byron Malott's remarks as well, on the nature of the corporations as institutions for realizing the aspirations of Alaska Natives. So that's how I would repeat the question. How can Natives own land or stock as individuals and promote cultural values as whole communities? And again, I don't have an answer to that, or purport to.
Okay.
Could you follow me?
He should be answered, all right.
Here's the party policy report.
Oh, good.
I'm on that one article about McBeath's book is right here.
Okay, you got a part. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Here's his latest book. I'm not going to give this to you because I'm reading it myself.
Oh, this is mine?
This is yours.
Oh,
yeah.
My, how tight.
And if you give me your name and address, I can put you on the mailing list.
Okay, I'll give you a card right now. Yeah, use the marker.
Yeah.
But these are the recognized
You live in Fairbanks, don't you, Don?
Yeah.
Vinatai is north of there. Well, let's take our seats again, shall we? Well, Martha Dementiev, you were going to respond to David Case's question.
His question sort of shocked me into attention, and I don't really feel I can answer the question, and I'm glad you said that you wanted everyone to respond to it. I just didn't want it to slip by us because I think that's what we're really talking about. But first, before I start on that, I would like to suggest that the task of this commission be explained more thoroughly in the villages as soon as possible. And the reason I say that is because there's a lot of fear. I got a call from home yesterday saying that the Department of the Interior is going to use this report as the Bible in their dealings with Native people. So if you're going to speak for us, be strong and speak forcefully and all that. And I don't think I can understand the fear. And I think all we need to fix that is clear explanation of what this is about in the villages. Another thing, one of the people I've always respected so much in my life was Fred Paul's father and likewise Mr. Paul. But was as he was talking about the IRA, I had the same feeling of getting on the fast train because it's leaving the station, as I did when we were being pushed by ANCSA. I think that it's going to take a lot of telling the people back home what this is all about. And I don't think we should be forced by time, by the fact that 1991 is roaring at us, to just jump on anything that comes along. It makes me feel scared. And now, after all that, I forgot what I was going to say about his question. Well, I think that we should provide some of the definitions, like I said yesterday. We should have made it clear what land meant to us. And if people are going to have a settlement like this, it will have to be up to those people to make their needs clear. I think that's where we bogged down, and I think that Myron answered most of those questions. But we're really late on educating. We were always saying education came to us from the white people. I think that we're very late in educating the white people from our side of it. We have knowledge to share, and our feeling about the land and how important it is to us should have been explained clearly. One thing that is a worry to me is that the regional corporations have subsurface rights to the land in the villages, and they have to make a profit. So right there, there's conflict. And I think that that is going to come out clearer in the village hearings. Before anybody came to our area from outside, every place had a name, and the name usually told us what it had on it. Every place was some where there was something we could get in order to help us survive. And just because we didn't use oil or coal and things like that, we didn't have a way of thinking about it. I really want to hear what the rest of these people have to say about our relationship to the land and how we can make it work with the idea of making money off of it. But I think that we could copy people like the conservationists who force people to reserve parts of the land in its wild and natural state. We could force ourselves, even if we take something out of the ground, to put it back the way it was. We could make sure in our planning that we're not going to put so much pressure on the land from development that the animals will move away from our area, that we could slow down and develop a little slower. And that's all. I just wanted to kind of open it so it wouldn't slip away.
Mr. Hope, would you like to add something at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm a little maybe frightened is the word. I kind of think that Fred Paul indicated that if some of the suggestions were implemented into the act, we would all be millionaires. I think that probably would have eradicated our culture faster than anything else. We'd all be luxuriating in Hawaii 6 months out of the year. And maybe this is a blessing in disguise. The question that Mr. Case asked, I think, as I understand the question, how can natives own land or stock as individuals and hold cultural values as a community? I think that's very, very easy to do if we're talking about the context of where we are today, because we all have stock. We don't own land as individuals, but we are still very conscious of our culture, probably even more so now than we have been at any other time, at least in our region, because we think maybe it might be slipping away from us. Culture, of course, is a changing thing, and we can adapt to those kinds of things. I don't see any great harm, if I understand the question correctly. Commenting on the disadvantages that Mr. Paul, I wanted to say something for Rosita. She wanted to, she asked a question about Lincoln Highlands several days ago, and all the attributes that Mr. Paul indicated that are part and parcel of IRA tribes are also incorporated in the Tlingit and Haida tribes, with the exception that the Secretary does not approve the amendments to our Constitution. We merely advise the Secretary when we do those things. However, in our rules of election, the Secretary controls that, And whenever we amend our rules of election, the secretary must approve that, and that's delegated down to the area director. But all the attributes of a tribe that have been enunciated for IRAs also apply to Lincoln and Haida, and they have all the attributes of sovereignty that they wish to exercise. The disadvantage that most people find objectionable to, the secretary does have to approve disposal of lands that are owned by the tribe. And the act that Mr. Paul cited just says tribes. It doesn't say reservation tribes, it says tribes. So if we own land as a tribe, in theory, the secretary must approve any sale of our lands. And the Lincoln and Haida tribes do own land. However, we haven't sold any land lately. We own land in fee simple. We acquire land, but it's land that is attached to a piece of property that we might be interested in purchasing. I think there was a little bit of confusion. I think Section 2 isn't a section of the IRA Act that the secretary has authority to create reservations. I believe it's Section 7. At least that's the way I remember it. Section 7, the secretary can create reservations, and he still has that authority to do that. I believe those are the only comments I have at this particular time.
Anne, you wanted to add something, I think. Would you like to do that now?
This actually ties, it touches on David's question, but it ties into what Byron Malott was saying about the broad aspirations that were placed on ANCSA, the variety of things that that land claim settlement was asked to accomplish. I want to refer back to the issue of education and the emphasis that was placed on it in the testimony. Again, it was a land claim settlement, but education came up again and again and again in the testimony. I was going back over this last night, looking at my piles of quotes, the way I developed the five categories that we played around with more yesterday and the day before. And at one point, I thought education should stand on its own. I really can't tell you why I decided it shouldn't, but because it does. When people talked about education, they often mentioned other needs, health care and whatever came up. But yet, at the same time, the desire that the children have access, equal access to educational facilities, there must have been 100 instances within the testimony that I considered that talked explicitly about that. It was a major issue. Again, it didn't really have to do with a land settlement, but it was something that people were concerned that come be a result of ANCSA. They placed that hope in ANCSA, that their kids have the opportunities that often they had been denied. And as I pointed out in the paper, the issue on education was, in the late 60s, one of equal access, not assimilation. They were anti-segregation. They didn't want to be segregated in BIA schools that were often not as good as what non-natives had available to them. And again, as I mentioned in the paper, the dangers of integration, which are real, are still real, were not articulated. It's not that they weren't articulated, I'll leave it at that, whatever the perception of the problems were. That wasn't what was being talked about. The issue was equal access. And I think in listening to the last few days of testimony, I think that this aspiration has changed. I mean, education is still there, but it's changed in how it's perceived to be as an important issue. There is, I think, again, based on what I've heard here, an increasing recognition that along with land rights, education is critical in maintaining culture, in maintaining cultural values, and that cultural integrity and cultural values, that's what education is all about. This can be seen, again, in the push for bilingual programs that's gone on during the last 20 years, bilingual programs that are not assimilationist in type, that are not primarily there where you use the native language in order to, you use it for the first few years of school in order that the kids get good enough in English so that you can knock off the bilingual program altogether. That's certainly been there in the programs, but I think as far as many natives are concerned, that's what they've been fighting against. They want bilingual programs to be there, given equal weight, the native language and its use in the schools. On Nelson Island, I know over the last year, the council has been trying to get off the ground or get funding for an oral history project. And one of the goals of that project is to record oral history, not just in order, and not primarily in order that their views on their worldview be clear to people on the outside, but in order that they have that material there to use in their high school programs, that they have tapes, not necessarily written material, that they can use as curriculum. There's curriculum development happening on a more formal level, but I think this kind of grassroots curriculum development, and I don't think Tuksuk Bay on Nelson Island is alone in these kind of attempts, are really important. The desire of the elders that sat on the council to make available, to put into the formal education, they now have a beautiful REA high school, but it doesn't often teach what they want to be taught, and this is one attempt to make the sorts of things that they want available to the younger generation. And then there would be teachers like Martha Dementia who can teach in a culturally appropriate manner. She's not alone, thank goodness. And there's a growing number of Native individuals that are becoming formally certified as teachers and are able to participate in the schools. And that's been happening now over the years, and it's a real positive thrust in education of Natives in the state. And what